back to Kyra Knight. We referenced that we were going to talk a little bit more about the possibility of a coronavirus vaccine again tonight because there was a big development out there. And we, yesterday, if you were listening, we interviewed Jesse Erasmus. He's an acting assistant professor in the Department of Microbiology at the University of Washington. He's also a virologist working on vaccine development for the coronavirus. Jesse and I talked about the different types of vaccines that are available. We went through that. And then today, one of the vaccines that we actually mentioned in yesterday's show looks like it had a bit of a problem with data collection. And here's the thing. Whenever I get a chance to interview someone who's obviously very, very bright, they always do one bad thing, and that is they give me their phone number. And Jesse made that mistake, and so now I'm back bugging him again today, a day after we did our interview, because I am curious. This is AstraZeneca. This was the third of the three big vaccine announcements, and apparently there are some problems. Jesse, thank you for coming back on the show and talking with us.
No problem. Happy to help out.
So what is it looks like, at least the headline in the New York Times is this: after admitting mistake, AstraZeneca faces difficult questions about its vaccine. So what happened? First, before we even say what happened, what was the promise of the vaccine, at least at first blush, before we knew more about it? What did this vaccine do differently than the other two vaccines that already are been out there, the Pfizer and the Moderna one?
Yeah, so this one is slightly different. It's actually almost a combination of what we talked about yesterday between RNA vaccine and a live attenuated vaccine. In this case, you're using a virus, excuse me, to deliver RNA. Sorry, in this case, DNA. But you're using a virus to basically deliver genetic material that then expresses the spike protein of SARS coronavirus 2. And so this is slightly different from an RNA vaccine in that you are going to manufacture live viruses that can then be used to deliver these genetic materials. And these viruses are going to be a lot more stable at room temperature or refrigerated temperatures. So stability is going to be a huge advantage, as well as manufacturing cost. At least according to what I've read from AstraZeneca and Oxford, the cost to produce this vaccine is significantly lower than what you would get for an RNA vaccine.
And in fact, some of the British press were referring to it as essentially the price of a cup of coffee. You could get a vaccine for the coronavirus, and the fact, and we did talk about this before, and I've talked about it on the show, the difficulties of establishing a cold chain between manufacturer and actually into someone's arm is not insignificant. And so this one looked like it sort of touched all of the potential bases of being easy to manufacture, relatively cheap, and it's much more stable at normal temperatures than the other two vaccines that we've been talking about. And then this. So what is the news today about the dosing that they were doing in their clinical trials and the data collection that they were doing as well?
Okay, so I'm also getting caught up here a little bit, but it sounds like the major difference between the press release that came from AstraZeneca and those that came from BioNTech, Pfizer, and Moderna is that AstraZeneca was combining data from multiple different clinical trials, whereas the previous press releases for the other companies, you know, those were reports from a single large U.S. clinical trial, including around 30,000 participants. And so they were able to draw pretty robust conclusions from that data set. They were just waiting for a certain number of cases to be recorded in the trial in their placebo group in order to be able to draw statistical conclusions about protection. But in the case of AstraZeneca, I think my understanding at least is that they have multiple trials, one in Brazil, one in the UK. Both trials were slightly different from each other. So it's very hard to do this, what they call a meta-analysis, where they combine data from both trials. It doesn't necessarily mean that the vaccine doesn't work. I'm pretty sure that the data does still suggest that the vaccine works. It just really means that we need to wait until there's more data. These trials are ongoing. They're definitely not complete. And so as these trials progress in their respective countries, under different trial designs, we'll be able to get more robust conclusions. I think maybe it may have been just a premature release of information, but that's just my opinion.
So we're talking with Jesse Erasmus. He's an acting assistant professor in the Department of Microbiology at the University of Washington. He's also a virologist working on vaccine development and specific to the coronavirus. Jesse, what does this do, though? I mean, at least the tone of the story, and you can tell me whether or not maybe the reporters who worked on this went a little too far, but the tone of the story seems to indicate that there is maybe now a trust issue with AstraZeneca, that it put out information knowing that it had combined data in a manner that maybe isn't conventional, or at least if you do it, it certainly should be disclosed up front. I mean, do you feel like that's a legitimate concern in the medical community, or do you feel like that is maybe a little more smoke than it is fire?
I think it definitely, they raise a perfectly valid point. You know, and most of the time in traditional circumstances, these types of trials undergo independent peer review and then are published to the public after a rigorous peer review process. But because, you know, we're in this new era, you know, we're having this outbreak and we need results now, companies are doing what is, you know, referred to at least on social media as publication by press release. And so they're basically skipping this peer review process. But, you know, it's understandable because the public wants to know and be kept up to date as quickly as possible. And so by skipping that peer review process, as long as they are being very transparent and they are trying to include as much information as they possibly can, the nice thing about the Pfizer and the Moderna trials is they had pre-published a lot of the trial information, the plan. And so there were a lot of experts that were ready to weigh in when the data came out. And that, it definitely seems that AstraZeneca maybe took a bad step by doing this without disclosing everything in the outset. I definitely don't think that they're trying to hide anything or in that regard, but in today's day and age, it's definitely very important to get your message right the first time, especially when there's a lot of vaccine hesitancy out there. We want to make sure that the public can trust the experts and can trust the data that is released from these companies.
Well, then you raise another interesting point about all of this. Can you tell us a little bit about what does it feel like on the inside? You're working on your own vaccine. We talked about that yesterday. And do you feel like there is this enormous pressure right now? I mean, most of the time, this is a massively accelerated time frame to get a vaccine out to the general public, from inception to injection, is really compressed right now. And so what do you feel personally? I mean, do you feel like the folks who are doing the type of work you're doing feel under tremendous pressure to show a result, to get something out there? Because obviously there's a lot of money behind these vaccines getting out to market as soon as possible.
Yeah, me personally, I don't feel as much pressure, obviously, because we are much smaller. The company that we're working with to get the vaccine out is very small, and we don't have a lot of public eye on us, but yeah, for these companies that are kind of leading the way in terms of their timing and their phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials ongoing, I do think that they are under tremendous pressure, not only from the public, but, you know, these are public companies, so they are under pressure from investors, and it costs a lot to make a vaccine, you know, billions of dollars. And so there's definitely a lot of other factors at play here.
Well, and we're talking with Jesse Erasmus. He's an acting assistant professor, Department of Microbiology at the University of Washington. He's also a virologist who is working on a vaccine for the coronavirus. Jesse, when you talk about the amount of, investor pressure to get this thing out, and obviously there's health department pressure, there's pressure from business, of course, because everybody wants to see this thing with this idea that it's going to return us to something that used to exist in this country pre-coronavirus, which was sort of regular day-to-day business and social interaction, which has been gone away since the, or at least to some degree, has gone away since the coronavirus. But do you feel like this is something that maybe, and you maybe you folks in your community and scientific community talked about this, but this accelerated pressure, I mean, there's a reason that it historically has taken so long, this accelerated time frame. I mean, is this the type of worry or problem that we should have been expecting all along?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, are you trying to get at, is this something that we should be concerned about in terms of being able to trust the results or being able to develop something safe?
Well, I would say both. I mean, it is. Yeah. I'm assuming that the time frame that existed pre-coronavirus was there for a reason, and now that reason that has been compressed. I mean, I think everybody would have developed vaccines faster before, but there wasn't this sort of like immediate need. So, is there? Mm-hmm. Do you personally feel like there is any concern that things are moving along too quickly and with a lot of pressure to get something done fast and maybe with a little bit of carving away of what's actually safe or wise?
I definitely don't, you know, it's hard to say. Obviously, I don't have a lot of experience in this aspect of vaccine development, especially the rapid nature of this development process. But what I can say is that once the results of these trials are published, once the FDA has had an opportunity to evaluate the results of the trials, I'm very confident that if they come to a conclusion that the vaccine is safe and efficacious, then I will trust in that conclusion. I think, you know, the fact that everyone is under a lot of pressure is just forcing the process to occur much faster. But I do believe that the people that are making these important decisions are definitely going to take their time when it comes to reviewing the data. And the other thing is, you know, some of these, we're learning a lot, too. We're learning a lot about study design. But a lot of these people that have been doing this have been, you know, they've been working in clinical trial design for their entire careers. I don't have any experience in that, so I can't really comment too much on that. But I would just have to basically, to conclude, I would say that we would just have to put our trust in those specific experts and what their conclusions say.
That is Jesse Erasmus, acting assistant professor, Department of Microbiology at the University of Washington. He's also a virologist who is working on a coronavirus vaccine. Jesse, thank you so much for putting that in perspective. It sounds like what you're saying is that, hey, these folks have been, you know, doing this a long time. While the timeline is accelerated, the standards are not diminished as a result. And certainly the review process is going to be as rigorous as it ever was. I mean, is that a fair way to sum it up?
Yes, I definitely agree with your conclusion there. And I, the other thing I have to say is, you know, this AstraZeneca trial, you know, they admitted that they made an error in their dosing in part of their trial. And this has actually led to some really interesting findings. In fact, that error may have led to some new data that may actually improve the AstraZeneca vaccine and I'm assuming if they ever were to conduct similar trials in other countries, my guess is that they're going to now evaluate lower first prime doses followed by higher boost doses. And they say that they don't know why this is occurring, but, you know, there's already some speculation in the scientific community, and we think that it has to do with the fact that the AstraZeneca vaccine, it's a virus that delivers the genetic material, and so your body is going to mount an immune response against that virus. So the boost response tends to be less efficacious because your body has an immune response to the vector. But if you have a lower priming dose, you may get basically minimal anti-vector immune responses that may actually end up helping in the boost response. So, you know, we're rushing through these things, but the positive side to this is we're, you know, these serendipitous mistakes. A lot of things in science occur through mistake and error, and I think we're learning a lot from it.
Jesse, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights 2 days in a row, and I will bug you again as this stuff rolls through the pipeline. That is Jesse Rasmus. He's an acting assistant professor, Department of Microbiology at the University of Washington. He's also a virologist working on a coronavirus vaccine. Thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Thanks, Mike.
So I gotta say, this is one of the things that is the best about this particular job. And what I really loved about newspaper journalism is that you have these questions, you can read a lot of stories, but actually getting information from the people who know this stuff is terrific. And on top of that, I really like it when I talk to a researcher who says, well, here's what I don't know, but here's what I think. And I appreciate that. I love the fact when people don't state in absolutes and they understand that it is a little bit muddy. But his primary point being, hey, look, even if we're moving the science along quickly, the screening process, the peer review process is moving along as it always has. And it's extremely rigorous. And so we're pretty hopeful about what this is going to produce, including the AstraZeneca one, which came under a little bit of criticism today. So that is actually really good news for those of us who are looking forward to not only just getting a vaccine out there for everyone, but also a vaccine that can actually travel to the places on the planet and in the United States as part of that, that need it most. A vaccine that's a little bit more stable at lower temperatures, that you can get to places in sub-Saharan Africa, that you can get to India, and you can get to places in China and elsewhere on the planet where you don't have as much developed area and you maybe don't have the capacity, that super sub-zero freezer capacity to store a vaccine. This is all better news, actually, than I was expected. So, coming up next, we've got the random question robot. Then, of course, at the top of the hour, we are doing Stacey's predictions a bit early this time, because there is going to be no Cairo Nights tomorrow. There is going to be Cairo Nights with Jack Stein on it on Friday. And the Seahawks are playing on Monday night, so we're not going to have any Cairo Nights broadcast on Monday night as well. So we'll be back with Stacey on Tuesday. So her predictions are in. 98973. Get your predictions in and compete with Stacey right after the break. To Cairo Nights. So we had a suspicion that this was going to happen, and sure enough, it actually did. The state's unemployment department, employment security department, which has been beset by problems from March of last year, it feels like 20 years ago, March of this year through the first 6 months of the pandemic, could not manage its payment system very well. Part of it was a hack. Part of it was it being overwhelmed. And part of it was just, really inadequate responses to the prior to situations. Well, when the governor closed things down again, and one would hope that they knew that when the decision was made to close down indoor dining, and picking up with that decision, I'm more the effect of that decision. When the governor made that decision and health officials did, it was going to be pretty obvious that when restaurants shut down or go to go food only, but in many cases just shut down, that there was going to be a whole bunch of unemployment claims filed. We knew that. In fact, the week that it happened, according to the Seattle Times, unemployment claims jumped by 80% in 1 week. And so that 80% means thousands and thousands of people were filing for claims. Either they had filed earlier and then went back off unemployment when we reopened slightly and then went back on, or these are new claims unrelated to that. But likely it was driven by the closure of various businesses as a result of this worrisome spread and increase in infections. And we're getting a lot of reports that people are having a hard time getting through the system as they did the last time around. And in fact, it is getting rather critical. There are some people who simply cannot get through to get their claims. And remember, when we talked about this before, we talked about this a lot before, it was inexcusably hard for people to actually just get, or if they were to get their money, but also for people to even correct a problem because they couldn't get through even to correct the problem. The unemployment department has shifted now so it can process claims more quickly. It's reduced the number of hours it will actually take your call to solve a problem. So that happens between 8 a.m. and noon. And then the rest of the day, ostensibly, those people are working on claims. And to full disclosure, years ago, I've only filed for unemployment once in my career. I've been lucky, very lucky in that regard. That was when the Seattle Post-Intelligencer shut down print operations in 2009 and laid off a whole bunch of us. So 95% of the staff was shown the door. When that happened, I immediately filed for unemployment. And I got to say, you know, with when it's just one company, and I don't know what it was, how many of us were laid off, maybe 140 people, it was relatively easy to get through the system. And the people I dealt with in the system were spectacular. I mean, it every time I got someone on the phone, they were helpful, never really had a disruption in my unemployment. So I know I'm not criticizing and saying everybody in the department doesn't work well or work hard. They absolutely do. And when you can get someone helping you, it really does. It is a good system. And the state also provides unusually good benefits as opposed to some other states. So all of that being said, it doesn't really change the fact that when people are at their most desperate, which is when you lose your job and you're facing, you know, no idea on when you'll find another one. And then you realize that your whole industry is in collapse. And then you realize that other industries as well, and your options for other work become smaller and smaller and smaller. These are the times when it feels to me like the government really does need to step up, and it's tried to. I mean, you know, Governor Inslee's response overall to the economic end of things has been, it started off as pretty tepid. I think then the governor's office realized how tepid it was and has been trying to ramp that up a little bit, provide more money. And I understand budgets are extremely tight, but again, I hearken back to a column by the Seattle Times columnist Danny Westneat from last week that he said the governor essentially appeared to be completely blindsided by the economic end of things, not by the health end. Washington State has been exemplary in its real aggressive move on the health side of things. It has not been on the economic side of things. Like, you know, when you close down a business that you're going to get this massive flood of people filing for unemployment. And yet, once again, the system has been difficult to work through. I mean, nationally, it's happening as well. According to the Seattle Times story, initial jobless claims just from last week were 778,000. And this is nationally, not just in Washington State, up 4% from the previous week, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. In early November, Employment Security Department, which is Washington's department, reported a spike in new claims, which jumped 71% in 1 week. The agency later said it was a result of federal regulation that had required some individuals who were collecting federal benefits to reapply for state benefits. But this doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because the Employment Security Department suspended that reapplication process. And the following week, new claims fell more in line with recent trends. So look, I am a believer in the government providing help to people who are unemployed right now. Let's make that clear. And I'm a believer in being patient and understanding that when everybody's trying to get through the door at the same time, it is going to be a bit of a scrum and it's going to be difficult. But the Employment Security Department in Washington State, for a apartment that I would literally, I told people, I used to talk about and tell people, like, when I went through that, they were amazingly supportive, really attentive. They actually, I got, managed to get on, and I don't remember how long I was on, not very long till I pulled another job. And it was a lousy time to try to get a job as a journalist, but I managed to find something. And then, of course, I started doing some freelancing as well. But all of that made me think, like, man, you know, that's exactly what you want to feel like. You've helped pay into a system. And now you can actually help get back out of, get something back out of that system. But since the beginning of the pandemic, it has been a pretty unimpressive. Employment security has been impressive in its ability to be unimpressive. It has not seemed to be able to fix the problems, first with the hacking and then with the deluge. And every single time that we get, we know that when the governor was going to shut down dining, that was going to be a whole bunch of businesses that were going to lay people off. And we know that a whole bunch of businesses that were going to let people go. We knew all of this. This is an obvious effect. You cannot disassociate the two. It's that tens of thousands of people in Washington state. And the idea that they'd seemed flat-footed when this happened, or perhaps they did ramp up. It's unclear because they're not really communicating terribly well. Perhaps they were ramped up and still couldn't process this group of claims from people who are not getting any money at all. It's one of those things that I find so frustrating because we're taking, you know, broadly speaking, I've always felt like we should not be judged as a society by how we treat the people at the high end. Unfortunately, that's what we always do. We should be judged by how we treat the people at the low end. And this is why I've always been like, when someone has lost their job, and let's just set aside other problems and other groups of people who are marginalized by society. But when people have lost their job, they lose their own ability to fix their problem. And they lose their own standing. And let's just set aside their, you know, your emotional and psychological well-being. They lose their standing, their ability to sort of solve their own problem when you cut off their supply of money. That little bit of unemployment can be the thing that keeps those people in an apartment and eating and available to find other work elsewhere. And the idea that we can't create a system that can deal with these sort of like sudden surges in unemployment, especially when we are dictating the sudden surges. Now, I understand broadly it's dictated by the coronavirus, but specifically the implementation is us. And so if we know it's going to be happening at the end of the week, then we actually say, like, look, you're going to get crushed with these things. Let's talk about that when we say this, like, hey, folks, maybe don't file. Try and file today. It's going to crash the system. File over, or maybe create a system where if your last name is a specific letter, you file on these days. Whatever. Any idea that shows a capacity to actually understand that people are going to need their money and that we want to help them, that seems to at least consider that, I think would be an improvement from what we have. Coming up, the random question robot. And then at the top of the hour, of course, it's going to be Stacey Joe. We're going to talk some Thanksgiving stuff, some football stuff. Remember, I mentioned this earlier, get in your predictions. Stacey did her predictions today. Even though the game isn't until Monday, because of scheduling, we're not going to be having Cairo Nights tomorrow night or Monday night, and preempted by other things. And so get your predictions in now, and then we'll meet with Stacey again on Tuesday of next week. So all of that coming up after the break. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. We're facing down the, and I think that the machine appears to be, the Questron 700 appears to be in a good mood because it also is getting the day off for a couple of days. And so I think it's going to cut us a little bit of slack on the questions. And in fact, we'll find out right now. I assume, Shane, you are always ready, correct?
Yep.
And Frank, you are never ready. Is that correct?
That is also correct.
All right, then. Here we go. Shane.
Yes.
I bet I know the answer to this. I'm going to ask you anyway. Do you eat food that is past its expiration date if it still smells and looks fine?
Oh, boy. I sometimes I'll take a little bet if with the milk in case if I need it for my coffee, just right. because I can't do the whole coffee completely black. So I might play a little bit of games there, but for the most part, I try to do my best not to get sick.
I gotcha. What about you, Frank?
I'm shameless. Yes, I will eat a pass. In fact, whipping cream, right? Heavy cream.
Right.
Has a huge, long due date.
Right.
Doesn't matter. I'll stick my nose in it and use it in my coffee anyway if it's way past the due date.
Yeah, I tend to be kind of the same way. I think with certain things, I think with meat, especially if it's uncooked, I get a little sketched out there.
Yeah.
And I don't eat much of it anyway. But I would say with most other things, if it's in a can or if it's been packaged, certainly been processed food, I mean, that's got to have a half-life, 1,000 years anyway. Now, I am more than willing to go there when necessary. All right. Yeah. All right, last question. I think this is a last question. Who is the most creative person you know?
Oh.
So that one's for me, and I got to start with that one. The most creative person, I would say, so I'm going to put my girlfriend has a friend named Drea who seems to be like unusually creative in a variety of different ways, but mm-hmm. I'd actually probably have to put my girlfriend has an unusual perspective on a lot of things. She makes all of her own clothes. She took up painting and became one of the like graduated top of her class in the fine arts department at the University of Washington. And then decided that she mainly wanted to paint because she didn't want to spend money on paintings. And it turns out she's very, very good at it.
Wow.
She does it. She still doesn't do it as often as I think as other people would like because they see and buy her paintings and they really want another one. Mm-hmm. She does it whenever it makes her happy, but she's really kind of remarkable about deciding she likes something and also being such a cheapskate that she decides she can wants to do it herself. She was like setting out to like make her own boots at one particular point. I said, like, look, cobbling may be a bridge too far, but go for it. Shane?
I would say my mom. My mom's the most creative person I know. My mom has always encouraged me and my brother to be creative, to be artistic, to try different stuff. She's just has a really good knack of being able to pull stuff together, especially when it comes to events. My mom used to do a lot of big event planning, and whether it was from her getting the Dead Kennedys to play for a college radio station or doing giant exposés for the city of San Francisco Zoo and Billabong and all these other stuff, she always makes stuff look really pretty and nice. That's what my grandma does too. Every holiday, the table's always done up. There's always extra stuff going on and always just making something so ordinary, just like extraordinary. So that's my mom.
All right, Frank?
I'm going to pick two people from here. One is Rachel Bell, who, I've been in production. I've been in news for a long time. I have never worked with anybody who is as sharp and good. Her production skills are extraordinary, the way she uses sound. I think she's a terrific writer and a great performer. So that, and I would add to that Stacey Joe, who I think is a phenomenal performer and incredibly creative, and the dear departed Aaron Mason.
Yeah, I would completely agree with you on all those points.
They are just all were astonishing.
All right then, folks. Well, there you go. Last robot. Last time you get to see us embarrassed by the robot, although I think we did pretty well today and yesterday. We're kind of on a little bit of a roll here. No robot tomorrow. Maybe robot on Friday. That is Jack's call. He will be subbing in on the show. And none on Monday because you're going to get to the non-random question robot, Russ Wilson. And the Seahawks playing the Eagles on Sunday. So that will preempt on Monday, rather. That will preempt our show. So coming up after the break, we are going to have Stacey Joe on to talk about that very game, her predictions. Send in your predictions, 98973.